Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Thursday, October the 19th, 2017. Scott Spears along with you here on the Now program. It's such a big day. This is one of my favorite days of the year. This is the date of the League of Women Voters Candidates Night Debate, which will be tonight, October the 19th, 7:30 p.m. live right here on WWGH Radio. We will run from 7:30 to 9 p.m. absolutely live. You can listen over the air on the station, 107.1 FM, or you can go online, listen online, wwgh1071.com, or download the free TuneIn app and search WWGH. You can listen all those ways. But it is tonight, the big League of Women Voters Candidates Night Debate at the Marion Senior Center. And remember, if you want to come out to the Senior Center and watch live, you can do that between 7 and 7:20. Arrive there between 7 and 7:20 because we start at 7:30. And Adam Lepp will be there, Terry Tackett will be there, providing the assistance we need to get that program up on the air. And I will be moderating, which is always a great honor, and I thank the league for asking me to do that. So we're all excited, big night. Now today we are going to have open phone line conversation, but we're also going to be joined by the Daily Beast's Eleanor Clift, former panelist on the McLaughlin Group. We're going to hook up with Eleanor, hopefully, momentarily. So we are going to take a quick time out here, hook up with Eleanor Cliff, come back, conversation about what's going on in the world. And then second hour today, 1:10 to 2 p.m., we're going to talk about whatever you want to talk about. 740-383-9944. But we will be back momentarily. Don't you dare go anywhere.
Everybody's talking about Now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio, from legendary comedian Kay Ballard performing the fast food song.
Oh, there's one song that you like. I feel that, you know, fast foods have ruined the world.
Oh.
On the Champs-Élysées, on the Appian Way, there's McDonald's. By the Tomb of King Tut, there's a Chuck Full of Nuts and McDonald's. At the Scala, they sing by a big Burger King where the styrofoam boxes go sweet. What's the use? What's the hell? I just heard Taco Bell went and franchised a wing at the Louvre. You know, I could go on and on and on, but that's it. I love things that are topical and that are kind of true.
The legendary voice of Ursula from The Little Mermaid, Pat Carroll.
We'll do without gossip, for heaven's sake, Scott. Oh, it's naughty. But it certainly fulfills a certain catty side of all of us. Oh, good Lord. When you think of the gossip sessions you've had with friends over the years, it's wonderful. Yeah. It's like putting your hands in front of a lovely fire.
I will do anything you want, Scott. You know I enjoy being on your show. Because well, just let me talking and I keep going.
It's Now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. Join me.
And we are back 19 minutes past the hour here on WWGH Radio, and I do want to remind you one more time, tonight, 7:30 p.m., the only place you will be able to hear the League of Women Voters Candidates Night is right here on WWGH Radio, 7:30 p.m. Over the airwaves, online, wwgh1071.com, or download the free TuneIn app and search WWGH Radio, and you can hear that anywhere, and I am honored to moderate this year. So we'll have a good time tonight. But we're going to have a good time right now, too, because we have one of my favorite people. From years of watching her on the McLaughlin Group argue with Pat Buchanan and John McLaughlin, to her years at Newsweek and now writing for the Daily Beast, just as strong as ever. Anytime we need to get a handle on what's going on in the world, we shoot her an email, and she is so graciously makes time in her schedule to come on and talk with us. And today, like no other, there's no lack of things to talk about going on in the world. Always glad to welcome to these microphones Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, how are you?
I'm good. Glad to be with you. And you're right, there's always something to chew over.
You know what I have been shocked about, Eleanor? The two main stories this week, it seems, are we'll talk about Trump and the troop who was killed. Terrible anytime any troop is killed. But the Weinstein story is also there. But yet, it's kind of morphed into a political... I mean, CNN is covering that. Is there any distance between Hollywood and politics anymore? Because now Hillary Clinton is being brought in because... he gave money and la-di-da. Is there any line anymore?
Well, I mean, I think Hollywood has been part of politics now for some time, just like Silicon Valley is. And because Silicon Valley and Hollywood, those are the big bucks. And politics has gotten ever more dependent on money and donors. So, you know, I think you're right that all the, you know, the lines are crossed. And with Weinstein, of course, the media then puts out its and wants to know, you know, is the money tainted and are people going to give the money back? So that the story then has many different gradations as you, you know, it's always follow the money, obviously. But the Weinstein story is also about pretty dramatic cultural change in the society. I mean, on the one hand, I think people are shocked that this has gone on to this extent and still exists. On the other hand, we're now, you know, taking the protective cover off of it and examining it, and not a lot of people are going to be able to get away with this kind of thing anymore. So I think that's a huge cultural shift.
You know, Eleanor, what has shocked me about this story, and maybe about the Bill Cosby case as well, is that when it becomes news, when it's on the front pages of papers and on newscasts at night, I always hear, not just the accusers, they always talk about the accusers, that all of a sudden all the accusers come about. But what shocks me are all these people who say, oh yeah, we always knew that was going on. Why didn't anybody say anything?
Well, I think you have to go back. Hollywood and the casting couch, it's really kind of part of the environment. And I think, you know, women kind of assumed that this is the way it is. And you... figure out how to navigate this on your own. And if you were to speak out, you might not be believed. You could wreck your career. And look at all the times that Weinstein was successful in paying off people. So, you know, money gets involved there as well. I must say, I mean, it was a shock to me. I hadn't heard any, but I don't really travel in those circles. But I think people didn't speak out for a whole, you know, variety of reasons. And now there's safety in numbers, and I think everybody kind of felt it was up to, you know, they were alone, especially women. And now just the same thing happened with Cosby and with the folks at Fox, Roger Ailes, etc. When you're not the only one, and you can be fairly confident you're not going to be just pilloried and left out there on your lonesome self. There really is safety in numbers, and that's what we're seeing now.
In your opinion, in all of these cases, does this boil down to a mental defect? Is this power? Is it money? Because some of the people who have come forward, Rose McGowan, I don't think that, I mean, could Harvey Weinstein have shut down her career a month ago if she had spoken out about it?
Yeah, I really hesitate to judge any one person and how they handle it. I mean, I think everybody has to navigate it themselves. But I remember years ago when Susan Brown Miller, probably 30 years ago, wrote a book defining rape not as sex, but as power. And so I think, you know, power is involved here, but we do see these men, and I would even put the former congressman Weiner from New York in the category. They do seek treatment for with sex addiction, and so I think there are mental issues involved here, and I think Weinstein in particular probably has some pretty significant mental health issues that he needs to address. But the way he lived his life was bullying other people, and it was a power thing. So I do think, you know, it's about power really almost more than it is about sex.
Well, and I think that's what the Rose McGowan thing shows, or any of the other famous women who have come forward, and I think it's so brave of them now to come forward. That is a horrible culture to be going on what he did or anybody else did. It's just that audio tape from New York was just horrible to listen to with Weinstein.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that really does it crosses over wherever the line is from harassment into assault, and you know, harassment is probably punishable by a reprimand and maybe a fine, but assault is, we're talking jail terms here, and that's appropriate.
In the political arena, a lot of people jumped on Hillary Clinton this week for the money that he donated to her campaign. If so many people knew it was going on, do you think she knew?
You know, I don't necessarily know that kind of information would make its way to Hillary Clinton. I can't answer that definitively. I mean, again, I never heard of it, but I'm in the journalistic community on the other coast also. Apparently, it was quite known in the Hollywood community and among reporters who dealt with him and that sort of thing. You know, let's face it, I mean, Hillary is in a tricky position because of her husband's past history, and whatever she says, people are going to say, oh, well, you excused your husband, and, you know, now, and you wanted the money, and so if you could rewrite history, maybe if Hillary Clinton, you know, knew about it and took a stand and turned down the money and blew the whistle on Harvey Weinstein, we could have had a different election. but you know, I don't know that she knew one way or the other, or that she, you know, regarded him as different from the other Hollywood people who supported her race, and he supported many other candidates and many male Democrats as well. I think it'd be more interesting to ask, you know, what did the men who dealt with him, what did they know, and did they ever see anything? That would interest me.
Well, what's interesting is a good friend of this show's as well is legendary New York gossip columnist Liz Smith, and Liz. And I'm not implicating Liz in this at all, but Liz, you know, a lot of her information was stuff that people didn't talk about, like the National Enquirer, but a little higher standard for Liz Smith. I wonder if people like that knew. I don't know if they did, but, you know, if other things were going on, I don't know. It's a weird thing.
She writes a blog or a column, and it's very good, and I think she did address this issue. You know, I don't know that she knew chapter and verse what was going on. I think maybe she, like a lot of other people, you know, might make assumptions about Hollywood. Again, the casting couch, it's the stereotype. But again, she's in New York. I don't know that actresses would be confiding in her. I thought it was interesting. Gwyneth Paltrow did tell her mother, Blythe Danner, an actress certainly well known in her own right, She told her agent, and she told her then boyfriend, who was a famous actor now. He's married to someone else anyway, and he confronted Weinstein. So Brad Pitt, that's who her boyfriend was at the time, and he confronted Weinstein, but it didn't go any further than that. And Blythe Danner has a letter in, I read it in either the Post or the Times this morning, defending how her daughter handled it at age 22. So, you know, you could go to any one of those people, the mother, the agent, the boyfriend, you know, maybe any one of them could have taken it further. But in the context of the Times, and, you know, I think they all did what they felt was reasonable and comfortable. And then you have to realize how powerful Weinstein was. So nobody wants to go up against that power and the lawyers. You know, that you get a counter lawsuit unless you're really wealthy. You can't really defend yourself. And I heard one person say one of the reasons that Weinstein has been taken down now is because his company wasn't doing that well, and the business had changed, and he really wasn't quite the powerhouse he was once before. So the timing was right. So that may have something to do with it as well.
And I do want to just, Liz Smith, her column is out there, and what she basically said, this is a quote from her column: "Aren't you ashamed of supporting Harvey Weinstein all these years? That's the way a lot of our emails have been going since last week when the New York Times broke the ever-manifesting story of Weinstein's 3 decades of sexual harassment. The answer is no, and please don't try and guilt trip with us. We don't regret praising his legitimate prowess as a filmmaker back in the day. That has nothing to do with the horror stories unfolding here and now in 2017. We've struggled actually to write about this scandal, but just as it seemed complete, another ghastly revelation would surface. In fact, I assume between filing this column in tomorrow morning, there'll be another lurid element to the story. It's all over for Harvey. The end credits are rolling, and there are no DVD extras. And if you want to read the whole column, it's Liz Smith online.
Right, and she got a lot of hostile reaction because she was deemed not critical enough. I thought that was one of her points, because she, again, was urging people to view everybody in the context of the Times, especially the women, that they, you know, we don't want to start making women feel guilty that they didn't say more or do more.
Eleanor, Hillary Clinton, and kind of away from Harvey Weinstein, I don't think we've talked since her book came out. And one of the most interesting things when you bring up her husband, former President Bill Clinton, I thought in that book is where she addressed a little more about the extramarital affairs that he had had. And she said, people always ask if we have, this paraphrase, that if we have an arranged marriage, and she said, arrangement, and she said, yes, it's a marriage.
Right.
Do you think that's what their relationship is at this point? Do you think there's always been a central core, and it's not this thing that people make it out to be, that she stays for political gain in her own life?
They have been together since they were in law school. She's been with him when he lost his first race for Congress, and then when he won the governor's race, and then when he lost, and then he's now been with her through pretty devastating losses in presidential races. Now, I've been listening to her book on audio. Every night on the campaign trail, she said she called him, and that his comments and his assurances, you know, kept her grounded. I think they put back together after the humiliation that she felt over his behavior in the White House, and they then forged this really strong political partnership, and her running for the Senate, I think, was really her redemption and his redemption out of the darkest paths, parts of when they were in the White House. I just think they're a unit, and they've got grandkids together. I don't know how else you define a marriage, and I think they're strongly together. And I look at some other people who sometimes talk about family values and all that, and you know, they go through a couple of marriages, or you know, I'm just reluctant again to judge other people. You never know what goes on inside a marriage, but I think these two people have a very strong bond, and they will be together until the day they die. So, I mean, to me, that qualifies as a marriage, for goodness sakes.
To the news side of things, North Korea has threatened an unimaginable strike on the United States. Tillerson seems to be saying different things than the president. Is anybody on the same page here? And can North Korea do us this kind of harm that they are threatening?
The history of North Korea is their rhetoric is always a lot more than what they've ever even attempted to deliver. And President Trump has kind of fed into that by assailing the leader and mocking him, which apparently in North Korea they broadcast everywhere, so that people there really get insulted by the way President Trump is dealing with their president, which is an effort to sort of get the people in North Korea ready for any military action should it occur. I don't think you can assume that they're not going to do something foolish. They have lots of artillery pieces. They could incinerate Seoul if they wanted to, and they probably could get a missile to Guam, and that would be very provocative action. But I'm somewhat assured by the fact that the Secretary of State, you know, still says that, you know, he's working the diplomatic angles, and we've been to the brink with North Korea many times before. I think what the administration should be doing is seeking an Iran-type deal with North Korea. In other words, you're not going to get North Korea to fully give up its nuclear ambitions any more than you could get Iran to do that. But you can put a lid on it, you can monitor it, you can contain it for a period of time, and then you can sort of work to change attitudes over that period of time. But that's what they need to do with North Korea, and I think the president sort of, you know, threatening that he's going to pull out of the Iran deal, which is not just the U.S. and Iran, it's six nations, including Russia and China and our European allies. You know, it's not his decision solely to make, but that doesn't give confidence to other leaders that if you make a deal with this president that he'll stick to it. I mean, he's so erratic, changes with wherever he thinks the general attitudes are moving, and he's always so conscious of wanting to do what his base, the people who elected him, want him to do, and to try to keep his campaign promises, which are not always in accordance with reality once you get in the Oval Office.
What campaign promises has he paid off on? When people are up for election next year in the House and the Senate, what do the Republicans campaign on?
Well, that's why they're desperately trying to get a tax cut / reform, because if Republicans who control the White House and both houses of Congress can't pull that off, you know, you wonder what they can. I also think judges. The appointment or the confirmation of Judge Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, who's a conservative voice on the Supreme Court, is huge to the people who supported Donald Trump, and he's got something like 150 court vacancies to fill. Many of them were held open for more than a year to deny President Obama the right to name those judges. And so he has more judges than any other president has ever had to fill, and he's sending them up in groups of 3, 4, 7, 10. They're having hearings, and the Democrats are virtually powerless because they only need 50 votes to get them through. And the people he's nominated, for the most part, are approved of by the Federalist Society and a conservative legal group, and touted by the Judicial Crisis Network, which is a conservative advocacy group. So they're pretty far to the right, and you know, some of them don't even have quality confirmations. I'm working on an article about that as we speak, and it's kind of amazing to me the ideological nature of the judges that President Trump is putting before the Senate.
What has become interesting to me between the hurricanes and the football players kneeling and the story of this week, the widow of the soldier who was killed, the Russian investigation keeps going on, and we hear little tidbits that are not on the front page of nightly news at the time because of these other stories at this time about Wisconsin and Michigan were targeted. They're looking in to see if the electronic voting machines might have been tapped into. People are testifying behind closed doors. What don't we know about what's going on with the Russian investigation? He has access to the tax returns now, they think. What's going on there, and how long before we have an answer on that?
Well, there was a rumor several weeks ago that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, hoped to get this wrapped up by Thanksgiving. I think that's probably unlikely, but I would think by early next year. I don't think Mueller wants this to continue in such an open-ended way like the special counsel did during the Clinton years. And this morning, Trump tweeted, basically, you know, why aren't they following up on Hillary Clinton and James Comey exonerated her too soon. The investigation wasn't even over. So I interpret that to think that Trump is really feeling like the Russia investigation is getting too close to home, and he's lashing out. I think there is serious potential trouble for him in financial transactions that go back actually decades in his business, and the infamous dossier that was published online some months ago. Much of it has been proven to be true, not the scurrilous sex stuff that's in there, but the financial wheeling and dealing. So I think that's likely to be what Mr. Mueller will come up with. Then he will present his information, presumably, to the Congress, and the Congress will have to decide whether there are grounds for impeachment. So if it's financial crimes committed before he became president, I think that would be... that might fall short of getting Republicans to argue for or to support any kind of impeachment. But, you know, I only know what I read. I don't have any direct lines into the Mueller investigation. I wish I did. But he's very thorough. He's got a great reputation. He's going to do everything he's supposed to do, and conceivably he'll come up with nothing that's impeachable, or he will come up with something that Democrats will think is impeachable and Republicans won't, or maybe he'll find what we call the smoking gun, and everybody will say, okay, this is it, we got to do something about it. The possibility that Vice President Pence could be the president prompted a profile of Pence in the current New Yorker by Jane Mayer, and she points out that a lot of liberals who think getting Trump out of there would be the best thing that could happen, that maybe they should think again when they look at some of Mr. Pence's connections, particularly in the world of dark money, which, and Jane is an expert on that, and Pence is kind of a favorite of the Koch brothers, and he is much more ideological than President Trump on various social issues. So I think that's kind of quieted not only her article, but I think, you know, Democrats have sort of, they're not out there banging the drums for impeachment. And the Democratic leaders in particular, Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer, her, the number two, they have actually pressed Democrats not to go all out for impeachment. One, they think it's a very long shot to make it happen. And two, if you're looking at this purely politically, Democrats would be better off maybe in getting capturing one or both houses of the Congress if you have a weakened President Trump in there, as opposed to, you know, bringing in a supposedly fresh new leader. So there are a lot of, just a lot of back and forth, and plus the fact impeachment is and should be a very high bar to clear, and so none of us should be talking about it like a casual effort to get a president out that we don't like.
Well, you know, Eleanor, what threw me a few weeks ago was Steve Bannon came out and gave a, I think it was in an article, that he thought President Trump only had a 30% chance of finishing his term. Wasn't he there? I mean, that's an odd, he likes Trump, from what I understand.
Yes. I mean, I think if you're Steve Bannon and you're watching this guy operate up close, and I've had this feeling too. I mean, he operates at 2,000 miles an hour. I mean, every day. Even, you know, weekends, okay, maybe he does get some golf in, but he has more meetings, more speeches, more events than any president in my memory. And all over the map, there's not a lot of focus. I mean, today the governor of Puerto Rico is at Puerto Rico, and the sort of the slow response there is another big topic on the president's plate. So you wonder, you take the level of activity, the number of executive orders he has signed, the sort of the imagery of a lot of things happening, well, the regulations that are have been questioned and many have gotten rid of, and then you look at the Congress and how the Congress really can't function. You can come up with a scenario where Trump says, I have done all that I promised, and I've done it by executive order, and I've done it by deregulations, and the stock market is booming, you know, and the Congress sucks. I can't deal with the Congress. So you guys have fun, you know, I'm resigning. And that is an especially interesting scenario if you think that the Mueller investigation is going to somehow impact the Trump empire and Trump's family, and there's bad news coming on that front. So get out of Dodge before that happens would be the theory. That's the only way I can understand Steve Bannon's prediction.
You know, when this all started, Eleanor, it started the day after the election. There was a small article in the back of a newspaper that said the Russian Ambassador Kislyak was in celebration that Trump had won, and this was happy, and they felt they had helped him. And it was a benign story at the time because nobody believed it. And even into his inauguration, it was, well, they might have done something, but it was certainly wasn't collusion. And now here we are. And when you look at articles from what are pretty reliable news sources, voting machines can be hacked without evidence, September 12th, Washington Times, DEFCON hackers broke into U.S. voting machines in 90 minutes from Fortune, and now we learn that Mueller is, now that we know that Wisconsin and Michigan were targeted, certainly by Facebook ads and Twitter things.
Right.
What if we do find out that they were hacked into?
Well, first of all, we knew more than is general. The administration, the Obama administration, knew more than people generally did. And Obama did approach Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook actually after the election and pointed out that the Russians really had infiltrated Facebook, and Zuckerberg said, oh, that's crazy. Well, upon further investigation, it wasn't crazy. And then before the election, Obama warned Putin to, at the edge of some summit they were at, you know, to quit it because they knew he was at it. And the U.S. intelligence agencies in October made a public statement that this was going on. And the very next day, I think it was, the Access Hollywood tape came out. That's right. And the Access Hollywood tape consumed all the news coverage, and the reports about Russian involvement just got washed away. So there was more knowledge. And in retrospect, I wish President Obama and other officials then had gone to the rooftops and yelled it as loud as they could that this was going on, because at least there would have been some awareness. It's taken this long to come up with all of the details, and we're now looking at Facebook and Google and Twitter in a very different way when we realize how they can be used for these purposes and how there was really no oversight. And now the questions are being asked, are these giant tech companies going to be able to do oversight, or does government have to step in? And you see Sheryl Sandberg, it's been called a charm offensive. She's been here in Washington talking to everybody. I think, you know, Facebook does not want government regulation, and probably wouldn't happen under Trump anyway. But I think, you know, we're learning about how all this was possible, and I think the Attorney General Sessions was just testifying yesterday before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he was asked point blank, "Are we doing enough to make sure this doesn't happen again?" And he said, "No," so doesn't give you a lot of confidence.
It's just when I look at that, I think, you know, If voting machines were hacked into, because apparently there are 15 states where it could easily be done, according to the Huffington Post, and it wouldn't be traceable, that's a step, I think, in most people's minds too far. Certainly Democrats who wanted to win the election.
Right. But when you can only spend so much time reliving 2016. You know, I think Democrats have added up how many votes Jill Stein got for the Green Party in the three states in question. And if she hadn't been in the race, maybe Hillary would have won. I think it was like 88,000 votes in three states that you could put that many people into a good-sized football stadium. That's what cost Clinton the election. So we can't redo it, but there is going to be increasingly more talk about reforming the Electoral College. I don't know how you do that, but a new book out by Norm Ornstein, a scholar here in Washington with a think tank. He says that by 2040, I think it is, that 70% of the population will be living in 15 states. And those 15 states, which include California, New York, Florida, Texas, have the same representation as these underpopulated states like Wyoming, Oklahoma, South Dakota. And so the Electoral College really then is disenfranchising a lot of people. Now, in the Constitution, I don't know how you do it and how you would ever get the small states to go along and agree, but the inequality of our voting system is going to be front and center again leading up to 2020.
And the big story of the week, just yesterday, President Trump called the widow of a fallen soldier's called the widow as she was on her way to pick up the flag-draped coffin, and apparently did not know his name, and said that he knew what he was signing up for, and the Democratic congresswoman from Florida said she knew the soldier who was killed. It was callous. The family has backed up her story. President Trump says he's got proof that it didn't happen that way. What do you make of that story?
Yeah, you know, I've heard President Trump say that in many different forums, that they knew, they know what they sign up for, and he doesn't mean it in a disparaging way. You know, it's the power of our volunteer military. Now, when you extract it from a conversation, it sounds like he was really callous, and he's claiming he was in a room that a number of people, including his chief of staff, John Kelly, heard his side of the conversation. But, you know, I think the bigger story here is, what were those four people doing on this mission in Niger anyway? I don't think... I have no idea what we're doing over there, and why did that mission go awry? Why was one of them left behind for 2 days? Why did Trump not want to release the initial report of their deaths that was drafted by his National Security Council advisor? I mean, I think those are the real questions, and it's kind of sad that Trump himself actually turned it into, you know, who's a better commander in chief when it comes to reaching out with out to the families. And he said something almost offhanded that, well, other presidents didn't, and then apparently his chief of staff, who lost a son to an IED, I think in Afghanistan, mentioned, I guess, that Obama didn't call him. He did invite him and his wife to a breakfast at the White House, however. But to, you know, turn it into a competition as to, you know, who called more people or who did better, I mean, that's where Trump runs afoul. He's always got to be better than his immediate predecessor. And he has this urge to discredit everything Obama does. And, you know, I don't think the press looks all that great here either, you know, beginning to call up all the Gold Star families, although I must say I found it interesting that Trump promised to write a personal check for $25,000 to one father who'd lost his son. I don't think the government, maybe the government provides a payment, maybe that, I don't know what that's all about, but... the father has not received the check yet. The White House is saying it went out, so we'll have to see about that.
It's in the mail, I understand.
It's in the mail, right?
It's in the mail, so we'll hope it gets to him.
Yeah.
Almost a year since the election, so President Trump has had 10 months about. Tomorrow, 10 months. What do we say about the Trump presidency 10 months in?
Very disruptive. Has changed much in the way that Washington does business, has disrupted a lot of lives, and has passed no significant legislation despite having the White House and both houses of Congress. Chaos reigns, very unfocused presidency.
Mm. Can it get better?
It has gotten somewhat better. So yes, I think it could, and he still understands the segment of the population that elected him, and they are still strongly supportive.
Eleanor Clift, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much, and I'm sure we will talk again soon.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank
I enjoyed
you.
It.
Bye-bye. Eleanor Clift of the Daily Beast. Check her out. Interesting insight. League of Women Voters Candidates Night tonight, 7 p.m., right, 7:30 p.m., right here on this station. Big event. We're going to take a quick break, but we're coming back with more open phone lines and you on those lines right after this.
How did it come about that you chose me to do the first interview?
Well, because you've been very kind, very fair. You don't jump in and attack my mouth.